You probably know the hits. Hits?
Those guys?
You probably know the hits.
Hey everybody, this is You Probably Know the Hits. We're covering Tom Petty for the fourth and maybe final time. Is that right? By the way, I'm Jason. Is that right, Jeremy? Fourth time?
I'm Jeremy. And this should be it. Okay. Unless there is a final chapter that has yet to be written, I expect that this will be the last one.
Okay. Just for clarity, we are recording this in 2023, but we are not, gonna write off a zombie apocalypse there, Tom Petty.
Tom Petty was in the news today.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll start off with that. Yeah, just a fun Tom Petty news before we get into the issues of the day.
Sure.
And this is why the final chapter maybe has yet to be written.
Okay.
Right? So there's an auction house putting a bunch of Tom Petty's stuff up for auction. And it's some pretty famous pieces, like a famous black and white jacket that he wore, a lot of like blue jean jackets that he wore in the 80s, hats, shirts, like personal effects, not stuff he wore on stage, like a Los Angeles Lakers t-shirt.
Right.
And Tom Petty's family, I didn't know this was happening, but his family put out a statement saying, these items were taken from secure storage, they were stolen, please do not bid on these items, we're seeking help from law enforcement to stop it.
What?
And so I had to, like start Googling, like, what is all this about? Like, who stole it?
Right.
And I'm thinking it's probably one family member, like, stole it from another. And now there's like a, you know, cousin somewhere who's in trouble.
Right.
And I had to go to the most reliable news source of the day.
Okay.
Since Peter Jennings has passed.
Sure.
You know, the next reliable news source is, of course, Reddit forums.
Yes, definitely.
Subreddits.
Yes.
And
14-year-olds have the time and the...
Yes.
Definitely a more journalistic pedigree than Fox or CNN these days.
Yes, for sure.
So
so the Tom Petty subreddit is especially a beacon of the freedom of the press.
Yes.
And so basically someone said, okay, here's the real story, which... Right away, you know it's the real story because they're telling you it's the real story. There's no denying that.
Oh, definitely.
Right? Yeah. And it basically said that it, when Tom and his wife, Jane, divorced back in the late 80s or early 90s, Jane got the house in the divorce.
Sure.
And in 2015, she defaulted on the mortgage and the house was foreclosed on.
Okay.
And she lost the house and all of the possessions in the house. And so it's like the bank that has these possessions, and that's who's auctioning them off.
Okay.
So the family is saying, no, 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 Mr. Bank. That's our stuff. please do not auction it off. So
Tom,
I don't know how they
Petty
resolve it, but that's what's happening.
Versus Bank of America. This is,
yeah. And, you know, we'll get into it at the very end. Unfortunately, there has been a little bit of infighting in the family since he died.
Sure.
And he would be just mortified that any of it is out in the public because he was a very private guy.
Yeah.
We'll get to that a little bit later on, but
it, you know, happens. Isn't, I think Hendrix has had some of that.
I think.
I mean, whatever. It is what it is. The rock and roll stars themselves probably a lot of times aren't into managing their fucking estate and all of the possible particulars that come that could come from it. Little less when they die a somewhat, you know, early death. I mean, he was in his 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was, he was like 67.
You're tuned in more than me, but like when he died, I was surprised. I didn't know if he had, you know, I think it was a fentanyl overdose. Is that right?
Combination.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like he had medication in general for back pain or something, right? Or
a hip. He had a broken hip.
Yeah. Damn. Which sucks. But like at the same time, he wasn't like 92 and failing health in general.
No.
Anyway, maybe I'm getting ahead of ourselves on this last and possibly final episode of Tom Petty. So, okay, you got to help me remember, and probably everybody else too. We covered mostly Wildflowers last episode, and the summary there is that it was his second sort of solo album where he got to call all the shots. He was going through a divorce at the time. The one highlight story I remember is listening to it with his kids at a vacation home without having mentioned divorce possibly to them before. Just being like, what do you guys think?
Right. And his daughter was like, oh, they're getting divorced.
Oh, okay.
Like she heard the record and was like, they're definitely getting divorced. And that's, and Tom said he played like the song Wildflowers, like you belong among the wildflowers. You belong with your love on your arm. Sail away. Go find a lover. I mean, the words are pretty clear.
Right.
And when he played it for his therapist was like, so who is that song about? And Tom was like, I don't know. It's just words. And the therapist was like, that song is absolutely about you. You're writing about yourself. You're giving yourself permission to do what you know you need to do.
Right.
And it like, it took a therapist to turn it around and tell him that he was writing about himself.
Yeah.
So, you know, he puts the record out. He's not divorced at this point, actually. He goes through the whole tour. It's called the Dogs with Wings Tour.
Okay.
And they're still married through all that. And when he comes home, he basically tells her, we're divorcing. They divorce. Tom falls into a pretty real depression.
Right. Oh, you mentioned he had a drug habit for a little bit.
So he, at some point after Wildflowers tour, after the divorce, he moves into this chicken shack. I mean, it is like a house in the woods, like a chicken farm.
Right.
And he's out there just by himself, isolated. Stevie Nicks is a friend of his. She is basically keeping him alive, just coming to see him and take care of him. So she said he didn't know how to grocery shop. He didn't know how to do anything.
Yeah.
And he was just totally alone, like he'd never been that way in his life. And so he falls into this depression during this time, and he starts using heroin. And
which is quite the, because he had been a stoner and, you know, drinker, but nothing like that, right?
He'd been a stoner, a little bit of a drinker, definitely done some coke in the 80s. Maybe was still doing it at the time, I don't know. But, you know, heroin, I think everyone recognizes is a step quite a bit further than any of that.
Right.
And his friends kind of got wind that he was using it, or, you know, heard that he was, or suspected that he was. I don't know exactly how long that went on, but it doesn't sound like it took a lot of convincing for him to know he had to stop.
Right.
Like, of course you have to stop, but he didn't need like an intervention or anything. It sounds like he knew it was trouble. He knew he shouldn't be doing that. And like, it sounds like he sought help like himself.
Right.
He details some of that in his book. He doesn't talk a lot about it, but he definitely acknowledges that it happened.
Now, I thought you said the book was kind of the, like, a mishmash of stories from other people versus interviewing him directly, necessarily. Is that, wasn't it more, you said it was sort of like he authorized and wanted to be able to, you know, for example, acknowledge things or you know, deny them or have last word. But, so,
no.
the stories here are mostly, like, from Stevie Nicks on this particular thing, or?
No, they're from him and everyone. Okay. So basically, I mean, the author, Warren Zanes, interviewed Petty for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours.
Sure.
And Petty basically gave him access to everybody he wanted to talk to.
Right.
Petty would help set it up and you know, tell the person it was okay to talk to him. And so it was kind of an unauthorized biography.
Okay. Fair enough.
So what you're hearing is you're hearing his story, but then you're also hearing Stevie Nicks say, like, yeah, he wasn't taking care of himself.
Yeah, exactly.
He wasn't eating. He was like, it was a bad, bad, deep depression time.
Yeah.
But during this time, he also meets a woman. And it's a woman named Dana that he had met backstage years before in Houston.
Okay.
I don't know what her deal was. I think she maybe worked for a radio station or something. I don't know why she was backstage. They had run into each other, and then they ran into each other a couple of times after that, I think, and just kind of noticed each other, but nothing ever really happened. Somehow, he got in touch with her and said, like, I guess she was divorcing her husband at the time. They had like she had a 3-year-old son.
Yeah.
And he like tells her, like, come to California.
Right.
And for like months, she was coming up there like every other weekend, because that's when she didn't have her son.
Right.
Like, for months, she's going up to see Tom Petty every other weekend. So he's still using drugs. He's not in great shape, but he has someone.
Right, right.
And I think she recognized he was in bad shape and kind of you know, probably pushed him to get some help also.
Yeah.
But it's not long before Dana moves in. Like, she moves in with him, and eventually they would marry a few years later. But he kind of moves right on from his first marriage to Dana in a short amount of time.
So
it's not real clear.
Are we talking divorce was a long time coming though? Anyway, or?
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah. He knew for a long time his marriage had problems. His wife was pretty erratic, it sounds like, and also was they were both, you know, drug users.
Right.
But it sounds like it impacted her maybe a lot worse than it did him.
Yeah. A lot of times the person who's bringing the divorce has been processing it for a while, right?
Yes. And so, yeah, he'd probably moved on.
Doesn't hurt to be a rock star who has a variety of options.
Yeah, he does. But it's funny, during this time, and nowhere in the book and nowhere have I seen any other account of Petty ever being the guy who really slept around a lot at all.
Okay.
Was never known to be a womanizer at all. In fact, there's a funny story about it was the director of the Tom Petty documentary that was on Showtime, I think, called Running Down a Dream.
Uh-huh.
And it's Peter Bogdanovich. And he's talking to like Petty's stage manager or something during a show, off to the side of the stage. And Peter Bogdanovich is like, "So all these women, you think they want to have sex with him?" And Petty's stage manager or whatever was like, "Yeah, a lot of them do, but he's not really interested in that." Like, just was never his thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
He and I are a lot different.
Listen, man, don't make me do a lot of edits on this. Come on.
Anyway,
we can't do a tight 10-year on all the Jeremy groupies. Come on.
Not even drinking.
Time is money.
I mean, so, okay. So so Dana moves in with him. He starts to get some help on the heroin issue.
Now, just to be clear, was she using with him? You said they were both
Okay. No. She was squeaky clean.
So she was part of the factor of him getting better.
Yes, absolutely.
That's good.
And it was tough for a while. Petty said his kids didn't understand how he kind of moved on so fast.
Yeah.
And they were kind of being told that, you know, dad was having an affair with her and that's why they're divorcing.
Of course,
and,
right.
You know, so there's all that shit going on.
Yeah.
And that made it really tough on his kids. One of his oldest daughter was in college already.
Okay.
During this time, his youngest daughter, she tried to live with her dad and that lasted like 2 months or something.
Right.
He just couldn't take care of her. He was incapable of taking care of her.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she actually moved out to New York to live with her older sister because,
damn.
No,
so mom
no
was
parent.
In a bad sorts.
Mom was in a bad place too. There was just no,
yeah.
You know, no competent adult to take care of them.
Man,
it was a mess.
Yeah,
it was a mess. So he gets some help, and he's always writing. So he does two albums kind of during this time.
Oh, interesting. So are they super dark because of it, or
like
an you know, on. Sorry, I can't think of the right word. Uncharacteristically dark.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
I would say so.
Yeah.
There's one, which is the soundtrack to the movie She's the One.
Right.
It's got a couple of good songs. Angel Dream is a great song.
Now, that one, I thought I read that, is it not all or just at least partially like B-sides from Wildflowers? Is it?
Yeah. A lot of it is stuff that was intended for Wildflowers, but just didn't make the cut.
Okay.
So it's not bad. It does not sound like Petty at his worst.
Okay.
What sounds like Petty at his worst is the next album, which is Echo.
Okay.
I gave you one
by
song
his
to
worst,
listen to.
You
from...
mean like he's down in the shit or more he's phoning it in?
No, he's just down in it.
Yeah.
He doesn't sound like he's taking care of himself.
Okay.
His voice is more gruff than
it
has been
before.
Is this
the one that had that radio DJ song on it?
No.
Okay.
No. We'll get to that one.
We got to get to that one. That one.
Yeah.
That to me didn't seem too petty. It's pretty on the nose. It was, it's fantastic, but we'll get to it later.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the one off of Echo that I sent you was the song Echo.
Okay.
Which is a very just sad song that sounds to me like it's about heroin addiction.
Okay.
There's a lot of lines in there, like the poison came in liquid. And you know, to me, that sounds like someone who was in the throes of addiction and is coming out of it.
Yeah,
he's kind
of
coming out of it.
Just definitely a little bit different than like the lightheartedness of Mary Jane's Last Dance kind of thing.
Oh, God, you know? So different. Right. And he has said that he shouldn't have been making an album at the time. Yeah. He should not have been in the studio at the time. He was still in recovery. Like, it was just... But that's what he did.
Yeah.
He made music. He wrote songs.
Yeah.
Rick Rubin came in to produce again.
Okay.
There was some friction this time. Rick Rubin was working on some other stuff also, and Petty didn't think Rubin was spending enough time.
Right.
And eventually... I think eventually Petty fired him.
Yeah.
And Petty just produced the rest of it himself. That's Rick Rubin's MO, though. I think the Metallica had the same issue with him at one point.
Yeah.
That he wasn't involved enough. Like, he was doing other stuff. And they've said, like, Rick is doing 20 things at once.
Exactly.
Time.
Yeah, that's what, like, I've heard too. Pumpkins, there was a couple of times where he kind of swooped in and did the, this one's good, that one's bad, this one's good, that one's bad. All right, I'll see you guys in a few months. It's like, all right.
Yeah.
You know. Thanks?
Yeah.
Question mark? You know.
Yeah, and
but I mean, I don't know. Tastemaker, who, you know, everything he touches turns to gold, so...
Just the fact that he produced it gets people interested
in it. 100%. Yeah.
You know, I mean, that alone
is definitely
worth
one of
selling.
Those guys that I've once in a while looked through that Wikipedia, right, and been like, all right, I'm just gonna check out every one of these fucking albums. Just...
It's ridiculous.
You know?
For a guy who does not have any music ability, he doesn't play an instrument. He doesn't. And that's in the Petty Wildflowers documentary. Rick Rubin, Tom Petty says, like, he doesn't have any music acumen at all. He doesn't play any instrument. He's kind of learning some chords on the guitar, but that's it. Like, the guy doesn't know anything about music. He just knows what sounds good.
Right.
It's amazing. Good party trick, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Party trick worth millions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So there's a couple of other real sad songs. There's Lonesome Sundown. There's Room at the Top, which is kind of the, I think that might've been the only single off of the record, Room at the Top.
Okay.
When they would do their promotional appearances, like Conan O'Brien and stuff, that's what they would play, is Room at the Top. It's just a very slow, very sad, very quiet Tom Petty song. And I love it. Sad Tom
now,
Petty
this,
is my favorite
the
Tom
Heartbreakers
Petty.
Record, or is this?
Yes, it is. Okay. It's the Heartbreakers. Yeah.
Okay.
Sad Tom Petty is my favorite Tom Petty.
Okay.
You know, too bad for him, but that's my favorite.
Right, right.
And this is Tom Petty at his saddest, just absolute at his worst.
This is why I'd not heard of it. 1999, man. Are you talking about She's the One, or are we talking about Echo?
Echo.
Oh, right, exactly. I'll cut that. Okay. Yeah, 1999. This is in the midst of Limp Bizkit mania and all that. Like,
oh yeah,
man!
This tour was the first tour that I saw him on live.
Okay,
and was blown away. I mean, one of the best shows I've ever seen. It converted me into a massive Tom Petty fan. He looked like he was having fun. Like, they looked really into it. All I had ever seen from Petty was these interviews where he's real monotone.
Yeah.
You know, he looks like the lowest energy guy ever.
Right.
But man, on stage, he flipped a switch and he was wonderful.
Interesting.
He was so
okay.
good. And the band was so good. Jacob Dylan and the Wallflowers opened for them.
Oh man. Okay. And that was like maybe a couple of years after their like super first flash in the pan, but still good. Right. I was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One Headlight was
out. Yeah, that's one of those records that Jane and I went back to a few years back, and it was just like on play a lot. Just like it's a good, solid, just, you know, afternoon listen.
So, you know, I love the record. I think it's really good. Tom Petty, before he died, was talking about Echo, and he said, there are songs on that record I do not even remember writing or recording.
Yeah.
Like, just has no recollection.
Yeah, that is the heroin signature recollection there. That's how, like, Jane's Addiction's whole second record, there are members who don't remember any of it, like, at all.
And he was probably on methadone at the time, and, you know, that's harsh in itself.
Yep.
He did virtually no promotion for it. A couple of appearances on Late Night, but that's it. He said he didn't do anything at all to promote it.
Sure.
They did a tour, but I mean, they played like one song off that record on the tour. Like, they were not trying to sell that album.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just kind of, and I think the guys
getting it back together, getting back on it.
So yeah, I think the guys in the band actually, you know, they've said that they like it. It's a good record, but it's sad. And Tom Petty said, you know, people called Wildflowers my divorce record, but Echo is really my divorce record.
Yeah.
Like Wildflowers is not really much of a divorce record. Echo is way more of a divorce record by far.
I got to check this out. That's interesting. Because Wildflowers became my divorce record when you mentioned a lot of this to me.
Yeah.
But it definitely, like, it has, like, a hopeful, you know, tinge to it.
It does.
You know, like
Echo does not feel...
Like, something's in the past, not something's coming up. Which is, I'm surprised to hear the divorce was actually after that. And, of course, the, you know, the story of playing it for the kids and the kids realizing at that moment, oh, shit, yeah. You know.
Yeah, and, you know, I think he was always a very private guy.
Yeah.
And one of the, I saw a Rolling Stone guy, one of his criticisms of Echo was that it wasn't blatant enough. It wasn't direct enough.
Okay.
And I guess I get it, but man, when you listen to some of those songs, it's like, it sounds pretty fucking direct to me. I mean, I don't know how much more direct you can get.
Yeah, a music critic, right?
Yeah, I mean, whatever. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
Such a high opinion of them.
Yeah.
But this is the thing. So during that record also, though, their bass player, so their original bass player was Ron Blair. I don't know if we ever really talked about him, but he was one of the guys from Gainesville. He left the band in the early 80s, just got tired of touring, went and opened up a swimsuit shop on the beach, and disappeared.
Now, I feel like we talked about like a drummer who...
Yeah, that was Stan
out.
Lynch.
Okay.
Yeah.
He was like, I'm
Stan
out.
Lynch was... Yeah, Stan Lynch was way more kind of controversial because he was more kind of at odds with Petty, whereas Ron Blair was just like, I'm tired of touring, guys. See you later.
Yeah, it's been 25 years or 30 or whatever.
Yeah. So they replaced him with a guy named Howie Epstein.
Okay.
Who was really well thought of. Good dude, good bass player. Petty liked him, sang great harmonies. He just fit right in right away.
Okay.
But by the late 90s, he had developed his own heroin addiction. Okay. And had become very erratic, wouldn't show up for stuff. He's on the album some, but I don't think he plays on every song. And then on the album cover, he's not on it. Like, the rest of the band is on it.
Oh,
he's
really?
Not on it because he didn't show up for the photo shoot.
Oh, no. Yeah, and there's four Petty, guys on it. Interesting.
Yep. And Petty was like, if he's not here in the next 10 minutes, we're taking the picture without him. And Howie didn't show up. And they took the picture without him. Howie died in 2003 of a heroin overdose.
Okay.
And so Petty had to, you know, they're ready for another tour. And he had to find a new bass player. And he said he really, like, didn't have the stomach to find a new band member. And someone found Ron Blair and was like, hey, man, you want to come back? And he was like, yeah, okay. So it's like he left the band in like 1982 and he came back in like 2002.
Okay. That's a good retirement.
It took a 20-year break.
Yeah.
And Petty was like, if Ron wouldn't have come back, I think I might have just broken the band up. I don't think I would have had the stomach to bring in someone brand new.
Yeah.
So they get their old bass player back, one of the Gainesville kids. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Next album he did was The Last DJ. And so we can talk about The Last DJ for a moment if you'd like.
Yeah, definitely.
You seem to have some thoughts about it.
I just wanted to pull up the damn lyrics. It's pretty on the nose. You can't turn him into a company man, you can't turn him into a whore. The boys upstairs just don't understand anymore. Some folks say they're gonna hang him so high because he can't do what he did. Some things you just can't do to put in the mind of those kids. There goes the last DJ, plays what he wants to play, says what he wants to say. It's a big, like, middle finger, I would say. And in particular, it looks like the record came out in 2002, you know, in our lifetime. And I mean, you know, shit, anybody who's listening to this practically, you know, our entire lifetime, practically, Clear Channel has been, and I'm not sure if that's been bought up by somebody else like Viacom, but is there even more than one radio vendor at this point? There's the iHeart Radio shit that seems to own a lot of podcasts and stuff, but...
And this is exactly what he's railing against.
Exactly. I remember in Dallas where we were, there were a couple of stations that were not Clear Channel yet. And there'd be like, do you remember something called like the Adventure Club?
Yeah.
You know,
just
a few people who had like their own thing. But the Adventure Club, I think, was on Sundays the evening, you know,
and you'd hear stuff you never would have heard.
Exactly.
Otherwise.
Right. It was, you know, or another contemporary to that was like 120 minutes on MTV compared to the rest of all the rotation all day long being
right.
You know, that Soundgarden bought, you know, 62 plays this week, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and if at 3 o'clock my choice is to play Limp Bizkit or this unknown song by this unknown band,
right?
I'm probably going to go Limp Bizkit,
right?
You know, unless the record label has put a nice new kitchen in our office suite.
And then suddenly
there.
Wilco is on the scene because of that nice new kitchen. You know?
And I did work at a radio station at the time that this album came out.
Okay,
this album, by the way. I think Clear Channel and or Cumulus, like, they banned it from their airwaves. Like, they would not,
could not play this
swear
song.
To God,
this is
you
worse
not
than
play
like a Marilyn
song.
Manson song that, you know, that says the F word 35 times. Like, this is.
Yeah. So, and of course, what he's railing against is what you're talking about, where you have one or two companies that own basically all of these stations. And what that means is there is a consultant, the worst human scumbags in the world, consultants.
Next to music critics, but maybe they're
Oh, right there. Yeah. Right there. And they are basically, you know, they're setting the playlists for every station exactly the same.
Yeah.
And so you can't have a Rush makes it big in Cleveland because the DJ in Cleveland started playing Working Man.
Right.
That can never happen again.
Right.
And Petty was such a, you know, fan of rock and roll and rock and roll history. And he knew what a roll radio played in rock and roll history. And this just ate him up.
Yeah.
He hated it. And the album is not just about the radio industry. It's about the music industry as a whole, or even the entertainment industry as a whole. But that song, The Last DJ, is just such a, like you said, huge middle finger to the entire industry.
Yeah. And very, very overt, very in your face. It's fun to listen to, though. You know, there are definitely songs like that of the time from all kinds of bands who had, you know, something to say about the record industry and what they didn't like about it. Man, it's catchy. And yeah, it's not really something that I would think would come from Tom Petty, right? I always go back to Mary Jane's Last Dance, you know, or, you know, Breakdown or something. And, you know, it's so on the nose and topical about something that a lot of people do not relate to whatsoever, right?
Right.
But at the same time, like, I mean, I guess metaphorically, you know, talking myself out of it, I get that, man. The, you know, just kind of the man taking over, you know, what used to be art, you know.
Now, he faced some criticism for it.
Okay.
You know, for one, that this industry has made him a very wealthy man.
Sure.
And he's certainly not making these records for free.
Right.
He's getting paid very nicely to tour.
This
and
is post-Napster,
2002,
2003.
So people aren't buying records like they did, but
they
are, you know, it's certainly more than they are today. You know, so there's that. And, I mean, I think that it's fair to say that the radio industry that he's railing against did him a whole lot of favors
through
his career.
Right.
Without any question.
Right.
And so,
is a little bit tongue in cheek, or was he taking some kind of stand, or
no? He was taking a stand. I mean, he was legit angry. There was nothing tongue in cheek about it.
Okay.
There's nothing indirect about it.
Yeah, that's for
it's
sure.
very clear. You know, it was very serious for him. I think I get the criticisms, but in the end, you know, I remember an interview he did around this time where he was talking about. And this is there's a song on The Last DJ that kind of deals with this subject as well. He was talking about these bands that sell Golden Circle tickets at their shows.
Okay.
Which are basically the pit, the front of the front of the front.
Right, sure.
And
yeah,
you know,
and
you pay $1,000 for those tickets.
Right.
And, you know, then you're VIP and you get backstage and all that. And he said, I don't do that. I've never done that. And he said, my top ticket price on tour, this is 2001, 2002, is $75. And he goes, and I make millions on the road.
Yeah.
Like I can have a top ticket of $75 and still make a lot of money.
Yep.
So, you know, it's okay to make money. At what point are you just gouging?
Right.
I think is you know, one of his real issues. He's healthy at this time. He's off the heroin, probably just back on the pot. You know, really just, you know, he's healthy
less,
and happy. And
Depeche Mode, Nine Inch Nails, a little bit more, Willie.
Yeah. Very, very much. Off the hard stuff.
Yeah.
For sure.
Okay.
Around this time he marries
Does this
Dana.
Last DJ thing like impact him at all. I mean, what does he give a shit about 30 years into his career, them not playing a song on the radio, right? They're like,
yeah,
I mean, they're still going to play Mary Jane's Last Dance instead. I mean,
oh yeah. Yeah. And I think, I don't know if he, you know, thought there would be any impact really one way or the other. But I don't know if there was any negative impact on him whatsoever.
Right.
It certainly didn't slow down radio play, except for the one song that was banned.
Right. Sure.
All of his more classic material was getting played like crazy all the time.
Sure.
And so, you know, he's still selling out amphitheaters all over the U.S. every summer.
Right. Yeah.
You know,
just took a swipe and got away with it.
I think it added to the lore.
Yeah.
That is Tom Petty. Right. I mean, really, I mean, because he was known to fight back against the record label, right, and, you know, all this. And now he's fighting back against the industry, and he's, you know, he acts like we would want to think we would act if we had his level of fame and fortune.
Right.
Yeah. Right? Right. And so, you know, I get it. Now, I saw him on that tour too.
Last proper record? Or does he do a couple more? Or?
No, he does a couple more.
Okay. It's not just because I'm noticing like that there was, looks like there's one greatest hits that was released in 2000, right? Which, you know, to me always smacks of, especially given that it's, he had that other greatest hits record already that was, mm-hmm, was that, I think that was a record deal completion record, right? Or I think the one that had, the greatest, was Mary Jane was on the last.
Yeah, the greatest hits was a fulfill the contract and move on.
Okay. And so 2000 between Echo and Last DJ, I'm seeing one that's called Anthology Through the Years. Next one, 2009, yeah, 7 years after Last DJ, is the Live Anthology, which I think I've listened to. Let me look at the cover.
Yeah, the Live Anthology is great. The Live Anthology is really good.
And so are those a couple, any, you know, we've talked before about like some of these things have been shitty record deals. Certainly by this point, he's got record deal lawyer stuff under control.
No, he's got a great deal at this point. He's got a nice studio at home. He's got a new wife and he's got a second large home on Malibu Beach.
Okay.
And the Heartbreakers have all said like it really got fun around this time.
Right.
Like it was just fun. It was relaxed. It was a part of it probably is by that time you get to a point where you don't feel the pressure to go have a number one.
Right.
You don't necessarily need that at that point.
Right.
Because you're a legend at that point. You know, you're already there. You're the Rolling Stones at that point.
Right.
So what else do you need to prove?
Exactly.
So they can just go have fun and just tour. And they always said when things were bad, when we'd go on tour, everything was good.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like as soon as you'd hit the road, everything was good. And they were fun. I don't remember if I told this story in the last episode, so I'm just going to tell it again. Or stop me if I have told it in the previous episode. But it was one of these tours in the early 2000s where there was a guy in a podcast was, he had played in the band that opened for Petty.
Right.
And they were on tour and they're in New York and they have a night off. And the guy in the band that was opening for Petty was like, I'm going to go have a nice dinner out somewhere on, you know, in the Hamptons where they're staying. And he was ready to go out. And then his phone rings and the guy's like, hey, it's Tom. And he's like, oh, yeah, Tom, what do you want? And he goes, hey, we're going to bring the buses around back and we have some grills. We're going to grill some hot dogs and hamburgers and just, you know, we'll see if you want to come hang out with us.
Right.
And like he said, he's never seen a band that's been around for that long do something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, hang out like, at all. Yeah.
And they're just hanging out behind the hotel. And not only that, hang out with the
goddamn openers, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
and they're just, yeah, and they're just grilling, smoking pots, strumming guitars and just he's like, I've just never seen a band that acted like that.
Right.
You know, it was really cool to see. And so again, this is by all means, it's a happy time for the band. Everything is good. Their old bass player is back now, Ron Blair. And they're having a great time.
I mean, to put this in perspective, right. Wildflowers was 94, 93.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Last DJ is 2002, so it's been, you know, almost a decade since all of that, through all of that, you know.
Yeah.
It sounds like that's firmly in the past, and it's just kind of steady from here on
time,
out, right?
Yeah, time does, you know, start to heal a whole lot of wounds.
Sure.
And that certainly was the case.
As does the second and third house in Malibu.
Yes, so that helps as well. So You know, and then he does another solo record with Jeff Lynne called Highway Companion. I don't really know why he did another solo record, but when he put it out, he said that would be his last solo record.
Okay.
So I don't know if it was a contractual thing. Maybe he had one more solo record on his deal or something.
Right.
Highway Companion's a really fun album. It's really good. Square One is one of my favorite songs of Tom Petty's.
Okay.
That's one of the ones I sent to you. Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
That is a really great song. It's a fun, he said it was meant to be like a driving song. You put it in your car while you're on a road trip.
Right.
And it's good. It got pretty good reviews. There's no hits on it or anything, but really fun album. And then he has this idea. Remember his old band Mudcrutch?
Right. Which is like before Heartbreakers, not in the middle.
Yeah.
Like just when he was literally in high school, right?
Yeah. And this was like his band in Gainesville. And then they moved out to California and they had a record deal, but their only record flopped. And so the record label like made them break up.
Oh, that's right. Didn't he just basically poach most of the guys out of it for Heartbreakers?
So he poached a couple of the Heartbreakers out of it, but they had to find a new bass player and a new drummer.
Okay. So they did go on. They still had like a record deal and everything.
Yeah.
It's just minus Tom Petty and a couple of these Heartbreakers.
No. Mudcrutch did not go on.
Oh, okay.
Mudcrutch did not go on.
Sure.
Petty poached a couple of Mudcrutch guys.
Yeah.
Came back with a band that kind of looked like Mudcrutch, but with a new bass player and drummer.
Yeah.
And the label liked the sound of that band better. And that's what became the Heartbreakers.
It's like literally the same core guys, but
yeah.
Is it, I think that you put one of those, you know what you did? You put one of those songs on the playlist. And I remember seeing that when I was looking through the song list. I listened to that playlist today and did not notice a change at all. Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. You would know better than me if back then there was a significant change between that Mudcrutch record and the first Heartbreakers record. But
I don't.
Strange.
No. That's the thing. You and I don't think would notice any difference.
Was it one record label versus another one? Like Mudcrutch was on record label A, and then when the Heartbreakers deal came through, it was a totally different record label?
No. I don't know. If the original deal was from Mudcrutch, Mudcrutch did put out an album.
Yeah.
And then the record label, if the deal was only for one record,
yeah,
then
it's done.
The deal's done.
Yeah.
And then the label probably signed Petty to his own deal at that point.
Yeah, okay.
And just said, "We want you."
Oh, that's true.
But find a different band.
Yeah, he's like, "Okay, yeah, I found some guys. They gotta like wear mustaches and wigs."
Yes. Yeah. That's very cartoonish way.
Yeah.
Hey,
haven't we met before? No, never met you ever. Yeah.
So he has this idea in the mid 2000s. He's like, you know what? I'm going to call up the guys from Mudcrutch, get them back together. And he does. He calls up the old bass player, the old drummer. And I think the bass player, Tom Lydon, maybe, he basically said, he answered the phone and he hears Tom Petty's voice like, "Hey, it's your old buddy, Tom." And he's like, "I didn't really believe it was him."
Yeah.
It was weird. I mean, that's so they hadn't like heard from him in a while, I would say.
Yeah.
And so he just tells him, "I want to get Mudcrutch back together. I want to get you guys out to California. You can stay at my house and let's make a Mudcrutch record."
Whoa.
And so they did.
Okay. Not just go on a fun tour, let's make a record.
No, let's make a record. Let's hang out at my house in my studio for a month and let's make a record.
Okay.
And so they do. And the guys, that bass player and drummer have both said like it was just so much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, they're just all having so much fun. They're having a blast. Tom is having fun because in this band, Tom plays bass.
Oh.
So like he's having fun playing a different instrument and not having to be like the lead guy. And so they write a song that's just kind of a rock album. I didn't put anything from that one on the playlist, but I put one off of the second Mudcrutch record because he did this again a few years later.
Okay.
But
man,
it's funny because
Heartbreakers get kicked around quite a bit. Like, it's like, "Hey guys, I'm doing a solo record. Hey guys, I'm doing another solo record. Hey guys, I'm getting the band back together," which is all of you guys except for you and you.
Right. Yeah, so like for Mudcrutch, yeah, he still had half the Heartbreakers.
Now, is that
he had
part of it? Like, you know, Blink-182 has had this situation where one of the guys was having kids and was like, "Dude, I can't do this like nonstop every year touring until this thing is dead." like, I gotta stop. So they, you know, mm-hmm. for a number of years, put another guy in the middle. Is that, does that factor in this Mudcrutch stuff where it's like, you know, kind of, you mentioned earlier, the bassist, one of them took a 20-year break. Was it sort of like the drummer and the bassist, or, you know, for the Heartbreakers were kind of like, hey, I need a break for a few years? Or is it just kind of like Tom just calling the shots? Like, you know, you guys are taking a break for a few years.
It's Tom calling the shots.
Okay.
100%.
Okay.
Those guys, if I think they would tour every year, they'd make a record every year if they could. I mean, they are waiting for his phone call.
Sure. They're doing okay 100%. At this point. Anyway,
they're doing fine. But yeah. No, they're all fine. They're all doing fine. But so Mudcrutch makes this record. Just one quick funny story about that. There's one of the, you know, the bass player or the drummer, I don't remember which one, said that, like, they would fly on, like, a jet from show to show, because they did this little, they did this tour of, like, these really small venues.
Man.
Like the Granada Theater type venues.
Right. And like, it really was, small. That sounds like a, if you know, you know kind of thing, too. Who the fuck is Mudcrutch, right?
Right. So they do this tour, and it's just so much fun. They're not playing any Heartbreaker songs at all. It is all Mudcrutch.
Personal question. Did you know of this shit?
I knew of it, but they never came anywhere where I could go.
Okay.
They toured, the first tour was mostly around California.
Yeah.
And like, they would fly like on Tom's jet from show to show. Like, there's no way Tom made any money on this.
Sure.
There's no way he made, like, he absolutely lost money doing that.
Sure.
But he said, like, there was one night where like the bass player was like, hey, you know, he had some special diet. He needed to find some specific kind of food. And he's like, when we land, I'm gonna have to go find a grocery store. And Tom was like, why? And he's like, I need this kind of food. He's like, room service has it.
Right.
And he was like, how do you know room service has it? Tom's like, this hotel will have literally anything you want. Just order it.
Right.
Like, and the, like, that's what a Mudcrutch tour was like. You are staying in the Four Seasons penthouse and flying on the private jet from show to show. And not having bad. A lot of fun.
That's quite a little bit of a step up from, good. I mean, I don't know, I guess for the core that were the Heartbreakers are like, yeah, this is how it goes. But,
oh, and yeah, and like, they lived at Tom's house while they were making the record, and just, I mean, they just had a blast. Great time. So he does that. All right, time for another Petty record. This is the last Petty record I'm going to talk about.
And this is the Highway Companion one, or?
No.
Oh, okay.
Highway Companion was right before Mudcrutch.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, Highway Companion gets Mudcrutch back together. Now he's going to make another Heartbreakers record.
Okay.
So Mike Campbell, the guitar player, had bought like a 1959 Les Paul.
Okay.
Like one of those super rare,
right,
you know, hundreds of thousands of dollar type guitars.
Sure.
A point that was made in the article I read about it, where they made a point of saying that Mike Campbell had to get a loan to buy this guitar.
What?
Like, a very wealthy, famous guitar player could not pay cash for this guitar.
Right.
And so he gets this guitar. He's playing some, you know, blues licks around the clubhouse. Tom hears it. Tom's like, that is what I want the next record to sound like. I want it to sound like that guitar. That's what I want the next record to be. So I put one on the playlist called Good Enough.
Okay.
And it's this super bluesy riff, really bluesy song. That's what the whole record is.
Interesting.
Okay. And critics were pretty split on it. Some of them were like, no, boo, we want Tom Petty record,
right,
you know?
Right.
You know, it's, I love it. It's a nice change of pace. Mike Campbell's guitar playing is incredible. Like, it's something he's never been able to just play like that.
There was one you put on the list that had like this guitar solo for like a minute and a half that was like a Slash level guitar solo.
That was probably Good Enough. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
That had to be. Okay. Yeah. And it doesn't sound like, it has the same guitar tone as Slash.
Exactly.
It's that same Les Paul.
Yep. And the same effects, you know, on it. There was a couple of parts that like just barely echoed of like, maybe it's the November Rain solo. It was something where it's like, hey, that sounds like they just dropped Slash. Even though the solo has been going for a minute, it's like, oh, that just, they just dropped Slash's tone in for a second there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's,
and this is the Mojo record, right?
Yes, okay. Mojo. And it's just, the whole record is like that super bluesy, really kind of raw. They recorded it live, so there's no overdubs. Like, it is all done live in the studio.
Okay.
All together. So really, the way, that's the way the band prefers to work. they made it, they made this record in their clubhouse. So somewhere in California, Van Nuys, I believe, they had some secret storage facility where they stored all of their equipment, and they had just a clubhouse. I mean, there's just a big couch in the middle of it, and there's amplifiers and guitars everywhere. And this is just where they hang out.
Interesting.
And this is where they started.
Does it sound almost like a live album? You said it's like live on the floor?
Yes, very much.
Really?
Yes, it sounds like a live album.
Okay, that's interesting, because what I'm seeing on Wiki is the next album, a year later, is called The Mojo Tour. So how different is that?
Oh, I think that's just a live. There's a few live
songs. Oh, yeah, yeah. I've seen like you don't know how it feels. Okay, fair enough. I was like,
yeah,
fair enough.
But it does, I mean, it sounds like a live record, and it is. And I saw him on that tour, and it was great. So I loved it. And that man, Mike Campbell is an incredible guitar player, and to hear him play this type of guitar was really cool.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, like, I remember so when it hit that solo, I was like, I don't know if I've ever heard like a, you know, more than a few note solo at all, maybe, on a Petty song, you know.
There's no
showing somebody at the front kind of stuff in the Petty song, right?
So it's I mean, it's a good album. Some critics loved it, some critics hated it. You know, some thought it was like one of the best things he's ever done, and I kind of am in the latter. I think it's one of the best things he's ever done. I thought it was really good. He's got another record after that, Hypnotic Eye. Nothing terribly memorable about that one for me. He does one more Mudcrutch record.
And to keep the timeline going here, so 2002 was The Last DJ. Mojo was 2010. That's the one we were just now talking about. Hypnotic Eye was in 2014.
So during this time, somewhere, gosh, it was probably around 2010, maybe. Might have been earlier, maybe 2007. The Heartbreakers get invited to play the Super Bowl. And Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers play the Super Bowl. And I think it's generally thought of as one of the better Super Bowl performances. It was just straight up Tom Petty rock and roll.
Mean,
not a lot of theatrics. It was just really, really good. And I watched it. You can go find it on YouTube. It's a fun watch. And they play the hits, and good time was had by all.
Good stuff.
They also get invited into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I think that was around 2012, I believe. They get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, including Stan Lynch, who had been fired about a decade before.
That's a nice gesture.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of controversy in the book about this. Because any controversy follows Stan Lynch. It's just something. It's always something with that guy. So he goes out to California to rehearse with him for the Hall of Fame performance because he's going to play. He goes out to California to rehearse, and then he flies back to Florida, and then flies from Florida to New York and meets everyone there for the ceremony. And in the book, he like mentions that he was really hurt that he couldn't fly on the Heartbreakers plane to New York with the rest of the band. And the next quote is from Tom Petty, and it just goes, "Hand to God, had I known Stan wanted to fly with us, he would have just flown with us." Like, I swear to God, I didn't know, like, Stan wanted to go with us. So even in the Hall of Fame ceremony, Stan found a way to be unhappy. But they play. It's a really, really good performance.
That's on YouTube as well, right? I think a lot of
There's a lot of it. There, Petty plays a role. I don't think it was the year he got inducted, but he plays a role in the in one of the most watched Hall of Fame clips, which is Prince doing the "While My Guitar Gently Weeps." Because Petty was up there playing guitar with him and singing the song.
Okay, I gotta check that out.
Yeah, that's Prince rips off one of the most like famous solos of all time. That was one night where everyone was like, "Holy shit, Prince can play guitar?
No way!" Like, dude, no, that's why he's in the Hall of Fame.
I knew he could kind of play the guitar. I didn't realize he was like a virtuoso.
He's up there for sure. I'm not a huge Prince fan because I think we were born a little bit too late. But like, Yeah, which definitely seems strange because we grew up, you know, with like, for example, Slash, right, being one of the greats or something, and obviously Jimmy Page and stuff. But yeah, Prince is, I don't know, top 10 all time guitarist kind of guys, really fucking good. But yeah, anyway.
We had a little technical difficulty. Where were we?
We're talking about Stan Lynch being a bitch and Prince being, you know,
guitar virtuoso.
Tom Petty got to play While My Guitar Gently Weeps. That's not bad. That's fun.
Yeah. He goes out, he plays, this is on YouTube also, I believe, he plays the George Harrison tribute show.
Okay.
Cool. They play the Beatles song I Need You, which is they nail it, of course.
Sure.
And this is, they have another tour. I think the last time I saw him was 2014.
Okay.
Where they had a
tour. Which is when that Hypnotic Eye record came out.
Yeah, at this point, they're just doing greatest hits tours.
It looks like Mudcrutch 2 was in 2016, I think.
Yes.
Looking here. Yeah.
They did a little bit more of an extensive tour that time.
Okay.
But still didn't. I don't think they came to Texas at all.
Sure.
So, and then in 2017, he goes out on tour.
Sure.
And plays Red Rocks, and it's a completely sold out tour, as always.
And to be clear, he's had like basically zero health issues in his entire life, right?
Very little serious health issues.
He's never had to be out of a tour because of, you know, broken bone or any of this, right?
Nope. Yeah. Nope. He broke his hand once when he was on cocaine and he punched a brick wall.
Okay, it happens.
Yeah, that happens. He's generally, despite the fact that he kind of abused his body for a long time.
Sure.
He's a pretty healthy guy, generally. Sure. And so apparently he had a fractured hip, like, before the tour started.
Okay.
And so what people were saying was, like, they're having to, like, wheel him to the stage. Like,
damn.
He cannot walk to the stage.
One of those deals where the contract and all the money has been set up and inked, and then they discover the shit like right before the tour starts or something.
No, Stevie Nicks said he just hated canceling. He just, because you can always reschedule and you keep the money.
That's
true. You just do it when you can. She said he always hated canceling. Like he absolutely hated it, wouldn't do it, and he wouldn't do it this time.
All the things I worry about never happen anyway. Come on, Tom. Damn.
But They said the opening act, Peter Wolf, said that, like, as soon as they would strap that guitar on him, man, he would swing into action.
Oh, man.
And he was like, he was fine. It was incredible.
Yeah.
He said as soon as the lights would go up, he turns into Tom Petty.
Right.
But if you watch video of that tour, for me, I can tell something's wrong. Like,
okay.
He doesn't look right. He looks like he's in pain.
Yeah.
He sounds good.
Sure.
Sounds great, but, you know, he doesn't look like he's moving as well. He looks old.
Yeah,
and
sure.
That's it.
Yeah.
And they finish up the tour with like 3 nights at the Hollywood Bowl.
Okay.
Which was always one of his favorite venues to play. On his daughter's Instagram, I mean, there's all kinds of pictures of her, like, and her friends going to the show that night. Like, it's a big family affair, and you know, everyone's there. And the tour ends. And his plans that he'd been talking about all year was the next thing he was going to do was, like, re-release Wildflowers with all of the unreleased songs that were going to make up, like, the second disc of Wildflowers.
Okay, like cut in, like sort of a double album thing? Or
how
this posthumous thing came out, which was like, you know, disc B just has the extra stuff.
No, I think his intention was to re-release it as he would have originally released
it. Man, that would have been awesome.
That would have been so cool.
Yeah.
And then he had talked about doing a tour of, like, smaller venues.
Sure.
Only doing Wildflowers material.
Oh.
And having like guest singers like Nora Jones. He mentioned Nora Jones specifically, like, take my money, Tom, however much you want to charge for this experience.
100%. Damn.
Like, oh my God. Like, that would have been, like, a crowning achievement,
right,
of a career. Like, so that was his plan. He wanted to go back to Wildflowers. He loved that album. That was always his favorite album. And he wanted to go back to it.
Damn.
And re-release it, tour with it. But he did say he thought that was probably his last big arena tour. He'd said that before, and artists say that all the time. So I don't know. Who knows if that would have been true? My suspicion is that would not have been true. because he's just addicted to it. That's what he did. You know, he's got to be on a stage. And one night, it was actually the night of the remember the Las Vegas shooting at the music festival in Las Vegas?
Yeah, yeah.
It was that night that he collapsed. His wife found him, called 911, and they took him to the hospital, kept him alive for a day or two, and he died.
Damn.
And apparently he was like the band was there.
Sure.
At least Mike and Ben were there at the hospital with him, along with his daughters. And
it was a fentanyl, along with other pain medicine overdose, right?
The toxicology report basically came back. It was all prescription medication.
Yeah.
Like, there wasn't, like, cocaine
right.
or anything like that. It was right. all, like, painkillers.
Yeah.
And, but so what they said was he had learned, like, the day before that the fracture was now a full-on break.
Yeah.
In his hip. It was just causing him so much pain.
I believe it, yeah.
I don't know how you fix that.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to just have a lot of pain for a long time, probably.
Yeah.
You're probably going to get a hip replacement is what
right.
you're going to do.
Right.
But
in the meantime, until that thing's replaced, you're going to be, you know, tapping that little morphine line at the hospital bed, if that's
right.
where you are. You know, I mean.
So, you know, he wasn't just sitting around getting high for fun. I mean, he was trying to kill a significant level of pain. And Stevie Nicks said that after that, you know, after he died, like, because she was one of his best friends, that she knew he was in pain and he should have canceled the damn tour.
Yeah.
And that's what he should have done. He should have taken care of himself. And he didn't because he refused to cancel shows.
Man.
And, you know, that's.
God damn, all he needed to do was get a surgery, you know.
Give it a year.
And like I said, if he's on a 10 out of 10 pain for a while, I mean, yeah. I get it. That's hard to manage.
So they also found in his autopsy that he had emphysema, which is not a shocker. He was a pretty big smoker his entire life.
Okay.
I don't think he ever gave that up.
Right.
One of the last times I saw him was in Austin at the Frank Irwin Center. This was 2012, and he was smoking cigarettes on stage.
Yeah.
Wow. Which
in
was
Austin,
actually
at 2012.
Which was weird.
That last DJ stuff is shit. Damn.
Yeah, it was weird because I'd never seen him do that before. Like, I'd never, like, he would, I guess he could always get through a show without smoking, but that night he couldn't. Like, and he was smoking kind of throughout the show.
Listen, man, Texas takes
weird.
A toll on everybody, okay?
It really does. It really does. So, you know, of course, you know, all the tributes come in. Everyone loved Tom Petty, yada, yada,
sure,
yada.
Sure, of course.
Yada.
Yeah.
Band is devastated.
Legend.
You know, and I think, you know, for me, it was a huge, I mean, he's my number one.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, he's my all time favorite. And I mean, to me, I wasn't ready for him to go.
Yeah.
I was ready for the next tour.
It was a total surprise to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was ready for the next record, next tour, whatever he's going to do.
Yeah.
You know, sign me up. And so after he dies, it is funny, at his funeral, supposedly they gave out a, quote, funeral t-shirt, like a tour t-shirt.
Okay, I'm going to be on eBay right quick. That's awesome. That's hilarious.
That's just genius.
Yeah,
absolute genius. Especially given how much he loved touring. Like, that's what he would have wanted, right?
Yeah, sure. Exactly. That's so funny.
Absolutely.
That's probably in his goddamn will.
So there's a little bit of infighting after he dies. With
sure,
the family.
You mean like between the family or like the band?
Yeah. No, the family. Yeah. Where basically what he did was he left all of his, you know, empire.
Sure.
To his current wife, Dana. 50%. No, like 33 to her.
Okay.
And then 33 to his other daughter, 33 to his other daughter.
Okay.
Right. So basically. And in any business decisions, like, they each get a vote. Well, the daughters were basically
so, like,
voting.
All the music stuff. Instead of it just being kind of like residuals from stuff that sells, it's like any, you know, like the Nirvana situation, right? Where Courtney Love has Kurt's vote on anything Nirvana puts out ever.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's difficult. Yeah. Okay.
You know, so that is that, and when it comes down to decision making, the girls are voting in a block, right? So they're voting together all the time, and they're freezing Dana out.
Yeah.
And the fact that we are talking about this would mortify him beyond belief.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah,
this is
shit. Like, why is
the
that public?
Right. But it was things. And then the lawsuit, she, you know, the wife filed a lawsuit and saying, alleging that, like, you know, one daughter floated an idea of, like, coming out with, like, a Tom Petty line of salad dressing, kind of like Newman's own, like Paul Newman's. And she was like, I cannot even imagine how mortified Tom would be that that was even floated as an idea.
Yeah,
like, exactly. She put that in her court filing. Like,
right.
You know, and they wanted to immediately start re-releasing stuff. And
to all their credit anyway, a year or two ago, that Wildflowers re-release, the remaster and everything, I thought it was pretty tasteful. And what a release for, like, a Wildflowers fan, where it's like a 5-CD thing. There's a vinyl version of it. It's tons of vinyls. It has that all the rest with all the B-sides and stuff on it. I mean,
yeah,
super awesome release. I don't know. You know better than me if there's been any blunders that have been, like, other releases that have been rushed. You know, this reminds me of, like, the Hendrix kind of thing where, you know, I remember, I guess it was in the 90s or something, reading a little bit about, like, some family infighting and stuff. And then suddenly the floodgates let loose, and it'd be like every year there'd be like, suddenly here's the Hendrix BBC sessions remastered, super high quality and stuff. As a fan, fucking cool. But it's like, there's like dozens of them. I don't know what the quality of all of them are, but every time I go to the CD store, I still see one I'd never seen before. That's an official, you know, some live show release thing that family, you know, for the fans, or milking it or whatever, it, you know, it's happening. How's that shit going? Is Wildflowers the only thing that's been released since he passed, or?
It is not.
Okay.
There were two compilations that came out before then, and they were both, I think they caught some criticism because they were kind of similar.
Okay. Greatest hits or like live shows?
No, one was just called American Treasure.
Okay.
Tom Petty. And this caused controversy right away because the daughters released it as Tom Petty. Well, the Heartbreakers and Mike Campbell and Ben Montench are the two official Heartbreakers remaining.
Sure.
And so the Heartbreakers are like, wait a minute, those are all Heartbreaker songs. You got to release it under the Heartbreakers name. I believe there is a financial incentive for them to want that, but I also think that is absolutely the right thing to do.
100%.
Like, how do you release it as Tom Petty without the Heartbreakers when it's all Heartbreaker songs?
Yeah, in particular, they have on the wiki, they have some of the writing credits to it. And, like, you know, Mike Campbell's all the fuck up and down the list. You know,
yeah. And this is a lot of outtakes, unreleased songs.
Right? Does the band not have votes and shit? Or is it like that the record deal to begin with was kind of harkens back to the very beginning where they're like, hey, Tom, you're it. You know, so he has.
I don't know what kind of ownership they had over these songs.
Yeah.
Huh. Is the problem. Yeah. I think he owned the songs. Yeah. They might have had writing credits on the songs, sure. But he owned the songs.
Fair enough.
Yeah,
and that's gotta be shitty. It's bad enough, like the Nirvana situation we talked about, right? Where there's some contention between people who were in the band and wrote the songs, versus, you know, the highly publicized, you know, wife of the deceased, you know, calling shots. That's gonna be rough when it's like literally you have no vote whatsoever.
And so they put out American.
To their credit, like, you would know better than me. Maybe I don't know, but like. I mean, I see, like, Listen to Her Heart in here. I see a lot of like, I'm going to go listen to this compilation, this American Treasures, because there's a lot that I, at least to me, I don't know. You know, but I mean, I'm like, there's
no, it's
two
worth
or three,
a listen.
Like, there's alternate versions and stuff, and I don't know. As a fan, I'm like, hey, this looks slightly interesting. It's shitty to sort of cut out the actual name and.
Yeah, but it's worth a listen, and. You know, they put that out, you know, it's some alternative versions, outtakes, things like that. There's some unreleased stuff. It's a good listen.
Okay.
But they put it out under only Tom Petty. Well, then the next year, like literally the next year, they announce another compilation called The Best of Everything.
Okay.
This one is more just a straight up greatest hits.
Yep. Looks like it.
Of all Heartbreakers and solo material. Yep. Now, at this point, Mike and Ben are like adamant, like, no, Adria is the daughter that's doing all this.
Okay, sure.
Like,
sure.
Adria, number one, we should not put something else out this quickly. Number two, if you do, you damn well better put the Heartbreakers on it. Like, you cannot release it as another solo Tom Petty.
Sure. Looks like it does have it on the cover there.
So they did. They got their way that time. But that was in the lawsuit that she initially said no to that.
Oh, my God.
That, like, she initially was like, no, because it's a celebration of Tom Petty, not the Heartbreakers. And, dude, she came off sounding insane.
Yeah.
She did. She came off sounding not good. Courtney Love's
got some company, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. And, right. and the wife came off as trying to be the peacemaker.
Right.
The wife came with, because, like, one thing that happened was the daughters were like, well, let's hire this guy to, like, be the decision maker. Like, we will each pitch our ideas to him, and then he'll decide.
Some record industry guy that the last DJ was literally written about.
Yeah. Yes. And so we'll pay him to do that. So Dana agreed to hire the guy that Adria wanted to hire. And then Adria immediately turned on him because, like, he started agreeing with Dana. Like, it's just.
That's funny.
And so, but then she was like, no, we're not going to use this guy anymore. And it just sounded awful.
All the legalese bullshit aside, I would say, too, this one was the best of everything. It looks like it does have, like, some other alternate and blah, blah, blah. It definitely is more or less a greatest hit. But it's a double CD, and there's stuff, like, for example, there's stuff from Mudcrutch in here, right? Versus you just getting the Heartbreaker stuff alone. I don't know. Maybe on this one, there's even more of an argument of, you know, it being Tom Petty proper rather than and the Heartbreakers. But I didn't know these existed. I'm gonna get to check them out, even though. So lead me into this one again. 1 year later, Wildflowers and All the Rest. Which is the one I knew of and was great. I mean,
so the lawsuit ended when they all put out a statement saying, like, we've agreed to put our differences aside and work together to maintain the legacy of Tom Petty.
Yeah.
Right. So it's just going to, we've all agreed to put our swords,
make the quality better.
We're going to put the swords away and we're just going to try to work together.
Yeah.
Since then, I don't know. To me, the daughters appear to be more the spokespeople.
Sure.
They're the ones who seem to handle the public appearances. Like, when Tom got his honorary doctorate, like, they went, you know, or the one daughter went, not his wife.
Okay.
So I don't know. Maybe they wrestled away the control that they wanted. I don't know.
Well, is
I
she do like know, Tom? It, like, she a private person?
No,
certainly she's almost as old as him, which doesn't
wife,
make her,
the wife Instagram, is a little more private.
Hungry, right?
So she is on Instagram, and she does post, and every now and then she'll post, like, a fun old, like, home video from the 90s.
Okay.
That's pretty interesting.
Well, I just
to
mean,
look
like, I presume these daughters are, like, in their 20s and 30s and not in their 50s, right?
The youngest daughter is my age, so 40.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, they're well into their 40s now.
Huh, old enough to know better, huh?
Okay. I would think old enough to know he damn well wouldn't want any of this.
Yeah.
Like, none of it.
Yeah.
One interesting fun fact, because you and I love these numbers.
Yeah.
The record label offered the family $1 million up front for the Wildflowers re-release.
Okay.
That came out of the
small, but also at the same time, like, a physical / even digital release in 2020 is kind of, you know, like,
that sounds like a good deal,
I guess I'd say. Not the best deal ever of all time, but, like, okay, like, you're not going to make that money back, I would guess, but okay.
No, but maybe you get more after you sell a few units.
Yeah,
but
I don't know.
You're not selling them. Who's selling them? You're streaming.
Yeah, that's strange, so, but okay.
Yeah, anyway.
Because, you and I were psyched about it, but I don't, you know, I didn't have 25 friends being like, holy shit, did you hear there's a Wildflowers reissue?
So they do involve Mike and Ben and Rick Rubin in the Wildflowers re-release. It's done extraordinarily well. It's universally applauded as great. The songs that didn't make it on Wildflowers were just incredible. They could have easily been on Wildflowers. I mean, they could have released a double album and it would have been twice as good.
Yeah.
I mean, It's great.
Right.
And maybe some of them are a little unfinished because they decided not to use them, but it's a really good re-release. And then there is a really good documentary on YouTube for free about it.
Yeah.
Where they get Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
They have all the home video footage from that time. They are in the studio. They're in the production room. It is fascinating about the making of Wildflowers.
Yeah.
And you really see
it's cool
because
there's a ton of footage from, like, when they're recording. Yeah. It seems like it was basically discovered footage, kind of.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It gave me that same kind of chill a little bit as the Dark Side of the Moon documentary, where there's like just a part of, you know, David Gilmour recording part of the solo or something to time. And then you being like, yeah, maybe that's it. It's just starting again. You're like, that was it. That was the take, you know?
I can't imagine like being a producer and hearing him play those songs for the first time.
Yeah, man.
The first time you hear Wildflowers, the song played by Tom Petty, who's just written it.
Right.
Like, I'm, you know.
And at this point, he was so seasoned, too, that, like, he probably, when he's pulling out a song, it's ready, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. He did some really high-quality stuff, you know, later in life. I think he became a much better songwriter.
Sure.
As time went on. And in the mid-90s, I mean, he clearly hit his stride.
Right.
But he did a lot of stuff that kind of resembled Wildflowers after that. I mean, he does some really good stuff into the 2000s that I listen to a lot more than I listen to something like Damn the Torpedoes.
Right, right.
And his songwriting, he could just, man, the guy could write a song.
Yeah, like, definitely. I would say that the ones you gave me today, like I was mentioning on our text, like you gave me this playlist that we'll put on the liner notes here.
Sure.
And it was just like, it was top to bottom stuff that was, you know, post Wildflowers. And I thought it was an album. It was completely consistent. Yeah. It was all very well done. Like I said, the one song that kind of sort of, I would say, took me out of it was like, wait a minute, this is like a long guitar solo. What's going on? That was that blues song from the Mojo record.
Good. Yeah. Good enough.
It was still great. I was just like, this is strange for Tom Petty to have like such a, like anything other than just like a real quick, you know, nod and a wink of a guitar solo. Yeah, no, I tend to agree with that. I mean, I don't know. Wildflowers is always going to be my jam. I definitely agree. Like I mentioned, that last DJ one, on the face of it, sounds like it'd be corny as hell. But it's like, man, it's a good song. It's just fundamentally, you know, a guy with a silver tongue who knows how to stick it to music very well.
Well, you know, he has a reputation for giving his middle finger to anybody he really wants. And
getting away with it in his older years.
I also think he's aware of that reputation.
Yeah.
And you know, he knows
how to sell a record. Flames once in a while, you know.
You do. Yeah. You do. You gotta give the people what they want. And generally speaking, he always knew what the people wanted.
Yeah.
You know.
Definitely. Cool.
So, he's my favorite. I listen to him all the time, and if you love sad songs, the later part of his career is just a really great grab bag of a good sad Tom Petty songs.
Definitely one of the all-time legends, man. This has been good.
That last song I sent you, that I Forgive It All,
man,
song.
You said that was like one of his last songs he released or something.
It really was. I mean, that was on the second Mudcrutch album, and he didn't have new music after that, so
it's a great one to go out on. It's really just the title of it, right? I Forgive It All. Right. Like, I mean, it's exactly what the song is like all the way through. And it's, I mean,
really great.
Yeah.
All right, man.
Cool. Guys. That's Tom Petty in like, you know, 7 or 8 hours or less. Catch you next time.
All right.